Chapter 14. Barbarisata versus the Janissaries. Ettrick, blade to blade. Lunchtime drinks in New Givet. The two killers nearest me turned and opened fire with blunt, large-caliber autoguns. I suppose the sword in my hand was a damn giveaway, but they'd have killed me anyway, even if they had mistaken me for a wayward bystander. They were professional killers. Vessarine Janissaries. They had a job to do, a contract to fulfill, and anyone in their way was a target. The fact that they were using solid round weapons confirmed they were Vessarine. The ultimate military pragmatists. They'd tailed the train in a poorly insulated speeder and deployed through a blizzard. In those conditions, standard LAS weapons might have died, their cell power drained by the cold. But a well-lubricated autogun would fire below freezing. It had only to rely on its percussive hammer action. Vessarine Janissaries. I had faced them before without knowing what they were. Now I knew, and their formidable reputation almost gave me pause. Vessarines. Three of them. Plated in combat armor and firing heavyweight man-stopper ammunition. Frankly, I'd rather have squared off with angry Kazrakin. But Barbarisata was in my hand, alert and alive. I had been using my will openly for some time, and that had quickened its strength. I made a gun facile, the figure eight stroke, and smashed the first three shots away, impact sparks sheeting from the energized sword blade. Then I struck an Uesar, an Ulsar, and a Urawaila Bay in rapid series, deflecting squashed rounds in the panelling around me. Wood splintered. I dived sideways as further shots punched into the hallway carpet and exploded on the interwagon doors. People were screaming in the cabins all around. I rolled and came up on my feet as the first Vessarine rounded the car-end corner and fired half a dozen times, his ejecting shell cases patterned off his torso in a fog of blue smoke, and his gun muzzle lit up like a blowtorch. Point blank. Except I was behind him. His gunfire shredded the wagon wall and ruptured the window frame. Barbarisata removed his head. The second one was charging and firing too. He let out a mask-muffled bellow as he saw his comrade collapse in pieces. I threw an Uragay sequence that diverted the white blurs of his bullets, then followed in with a Uin Tarwaila that chopped the barrel off his weapon, a reverse Tarn stroke that severed his forearms, and the Ul Kair, the death stroke. Hot red blood was already spurting from his arm stumps and steaming in the freezing air as Barbarisata plunged through his ceramite chest armor and burst his heart. The gunshot walls were painted with instantly frozen dribbles of bloody ice. A bullet creased the corner of my jaw with enough force to rip open the flesh of my chin and knock me to the carpet. I tried to rise, but the third Vessarine was right over me. I heard his weapon rack. He screamed. I smelt a burning in the cold air. I looked up. The Vessarine was trying to shield himself, as if from a swarm of stinging insects. Crezia's cyber-skulls were flitting around him, stabbing repeatedly with their surgical lasers. His yelps were cut off by the double crack of a LAS weapon. The Janissary collapsed like a dead weight at my feet. I looked down the hall and saw Alina Coy in the doorway of my room, holding her pistol in a defiant two-handed grip. "Alina," I yelled, "get the others out of the compartment! Get them out into the hall and move them this way!"
"But Medea," she began.
"Do it!" I ran to the cut-out car window and hauled myself out into the vicious chill. I had to sheath Barbarisata, and it didn't like it. Outside, it was bone-achingly cold, and the blizzard pummeled me with hail, hard as stones. There was precious little in the way of handholds, and the exterior of the car was iced up. I found something to cling to. Solid runnels of ice, I think. My fingers went numb. I hauled myself up onto the roof of Car 3, the vast snow-peppered blackness of the Atenate night above me. The blizzard ensured I couldn't see far. I could barely stand up. The convex aluminium roof of the wagon was iced smooth as a skating rink. A few steps along and my legs went out. I fell smack on my front, dazed and winded. Blood filled my mouth. I had bitten my tongue. Spitting blood and made angry by the pain, I dragged myself forward through the elemental deluge. I saw shapes ahead of me in the white-on-black maelstrom. Three more armored figures on the edge of the roof. They had lowered a directional detonator onto the window of the cabin I had shared with Amos. As I watched, they triggered it and blasted the window inwards in a hail of glass and fire.
The first Janissary began to rope down to swing in through the blown window. His comrades were hunched on the rooftop, anchoring his lines. I leapt up, and Barbarisata flew out, crackling in the wet air. The augmented Carthayan warblade came down, splitting the lines in two and cutting deeply into the wagon roof. The descending killer shrieked as he fell away down the side of the two-story carriage. The other two jerked round like lightning, one going for his sidearm, the other leaping at me with clawing hands. A Tarnweiler met him and bisected his head like a ripe gummis fruit. The corpse rolled off the car top into the darkness. I stood ready, Barbarisata twitching in my hands. The remaining Vessarine backed away, aiming a large-caliber auto-pistol at me. The two of us could barely stand, such was the blizzard's wind shear. He fired once. An Ulsar flicked the round away. He fired again, his feet slipping, and I made a Uin Ulsar that spat the bullet off into the darkness. My name is Gregor Eisenhorn. I am the man you have been paid to kill. Identify yourself. He hesitated. My nomklet be Etrik, badge of clansire, clan Zuber. Clansire Etrik, I've heard so much about you. I had to raise my voice over the storm. Vamiko Tal mentioned your name.
Tal, he be.
The one who let you aboard, I finished for him. I thought so. I had a feeling he'd been tailing me.
Be it he you just slew.
Is that so? Tough. Give yourself up.
I will not.
Uh-huh. Tell me this, then. How much is Pontius paying your clan for this work?
Who be Pontius?
Kanyar, then. Kanyar the Sharp.
Enough!
He fired again, and then lunged at me, swinging a power sword up in his left hand. Barbarisata knocked the whizzing slug away, and then formed an Uesar to block the downswing of the glittering blade. There was a bark of clashing energies. I switched to a double-handed grip and ripped Barbarisata in a crosswise stroke as Etrik tried to use his pistol again. The tip of the blade cut through the gun's body and left him with only a hand grip. But the clansire's sword, a short yet robust falchion of antique design, darted in and sliced through the meat of my right shoulder. I howled. I snarled into a letsouf that rebounded his thrust and swung reversing ulsars that parried two more fast cuts and put me on the front foot. Etrik was a big man, with a considerable reach and alarming strength. That meant even his most nimble and extended strikes were delivered with punishing force. I did not recognize the blade technique he was using, although I was aware that the warriors of Vessa considered sword skill one of the three primary battle arts, devoting as much time to it during their training as to gun lore and open hand. The very fact he was the owner of an heirloom power weapon identified him as an expert. My skills were a heterodox blend of methods that I had mastered over the years, but at the core of them was the Ulwaila Skrei, or the Genius of Sharpness, the ancient Carthayan sword mastery system. On top of the Trans-Atenate Express, any blade methods had to be semi-improvised. Neither of us were steady on our feet, our boots sliding on the iced metal, and the gale dragged at us hard. He kept attacking high, aiming for the throat, I imagine, and I was driven into a variety of Tarn-Fei-Sar parries with a tightly vertical blade that defend the head and ear. My own attacks were lower, von Ulls and von Uin strokes that targeted the heart, belly, and sword arm. His defense was excellent, especially a sliding backdrag that fouled every von Bey I struck in an attempt to push his blade down laterally and open his guard. His attack strokes were inventively arrhythmic, preventing all but the most last-moment anticipations. He was hideously skillful. I wondered if that was why Pontius Glor had hired these Vessarines. He was such a connoisseur of martial skills and warrior breeds. He didn't just want killers. He wanted masters of the killing art. In Clansire Etrik, he'd got his money's worth. I realized that the mercenary, with a combination of cross parries and driving thrust strokes, was pressing me back towards the gap between carriages 3 and 4. I was cornered with my back to the drop, my combat options restricted. I didn't dare risk a backwards jump without looking, and I couldn't take my eyes off his sword for a moment. I knew he would be building up to a sharp frontal attack that would either catch me with no room to dodge or topple me off the edge. Carthayan swordcraft teaches that when an imminent attack is unavoidable, the only practical response is to limit or force it. The technique, which has many forms, is called the Gej Kul Asaf, which means the bridled steed. It imagines the adversary is an unbroken mount who is going to charge no matter what you do, and that your blade is a long-range bridle that will control that charge on your terms. Ettrick was going to lunge, so I needed to reduce the lunging options. I went into an Ain Clusa, where the sword is raised, two-handed, with the hilt above shoulder height and the blade tipped down in a 35-degree angle from the horizontal. Sharp, lateral blade turns robbed him of any sideways or upper-body opportunities. His only option was to come in low, parrying up, to get in underneath my guard. I was forcing him to target my lower body, an area his swordplay had shown he didn't favour. It also required him to extend in a low, ill-balanced way. Ettrick made the lunge, shoulder down and sword rising from a hip-height grip. My bridle entirely determined the height and direction of the thrust. Instead of backing or attempting to knock his rising blade aside with a diagonal stroke, I sidestepped, like a bull dancer evading a head-down aurochs in the carnival pits of Mancarial. Now he was running his sword into empty space. He tried to pull in, but he'd committed his weight behind it. His left foot kicked out on the roof ice, and his right one went skidding sideways. Ettrick grunted out a curse and did the only thing he could. He turned his lunge into a leap. He just made the roof of the next wagon, his chest and arms slamming into it, his legs wheeling over the top. His falchion had a pommel spike, and he slammed it down into the roof to anchor himself, his boots trying to get a grip on the weatherproof plastic sides of the intercarriage articulation. I had seconds to turn my temporary advantage into a permanent upper hand. But my hasty sidestep had left me with no more purchase on the iced roof than Ettrick. My legs suddenly flew out from under me, and I crashed down on my back. I rolled as fast as I could and fumbled for a handhold, but it cost me Barbarisata. The precious sword squealed as it tumbled over the edge of the roof. I was holding on, barely. Ettrick's pommel spike shrieked across the roof metal as he put his weight onto it and dug in. With a few scrabbling kicks, he hoisted himself up onto the roof of car 4 and looked back at me. He chuckled an ugly jeer as he saw me worse off than he was. Still chuckling, he gingerly took one step out onto the top of the intercarriage articulation, and then another, balancing as he crossed back to car 3 to finish me off. Another 2 steps, and he would be within stabbing range. I decided which of my handholds was most secure, and I let go with the other, fumbling round behind myself. Ettrick came off the articulation, took the last step, his sword raised to rip at me, and found himself looking down the barrel of my auto-pistol. It was contrary to all the noble rules of the Ulweiler Skye to start a sword duel and finish it with a gun. The Carthayan masters would have been ashamed of me. But I wasn't feeling particularly noble by then. I fired just once. The shot hit him in the sternum and slammed him backwards. With a cheated look on his face, Ettrick disappeared off the far side of the roof. I was exhausted and drained from the extreme cold by the time I got back inside the car. The upper hallway was full of people. Stewards were ushering terrified and distraught passengers into other cars. Master personnel were gazing in perplexed dismay at the fight damage and the trio of Vessarine corpses. Elena was arguing heatedly with one of the master crewmen. Everyone looked round and someone screamed as I slithered back in through the window. I must have looked a sight, caked in frost and frozen blood from the wounds to my arm and chin. Crezia and Amos pushed through the onlookers and reached my side.
"I'm all right. Let me look at that golden throne,"
gasped Crezia, twisting my head to study the gash in my chin.
"Don't fuss. You need—" "Now's not the time. Is Medea all right?"
"Yes,"
said Amos.
"So you're all unscathed?"
"You're wounded enough for all of us," Crezia said.
"I've had worse," I said.
"He has," agreed Amos. "He's had worse."
Elena was still shouting at the trainmaster, who was shouting right back at her. He was a tall, distinguished man in an ornate, brocaded version of the transcontinental uniform topped with a navy-style cap. Clearly very old, his eyes, nose and ears had been replaced with augmetic implants, primitive, functional devices finished in boiler metal black that probably had been handcrafted for him by the locomotive's devoted engineers. Even his teeth, framed by a spectacular white tile beard, were cast iron. His name was Alivander Succo, and I later discovered that he had been master of the Trans-Atenate Express for 378 years. He looked like a bearded locomotive in human form. I pulled Alina back and faced him.
"I demand an explanation,"
Succo growled, his voice reverberating from a mechanical larynx.
"For this outrage. Nothing like this has ever happened aboard the Trans-Atenate. This vulgar violence and impropriety."
Impropriety? I echoed.
Are you responsible for this?
He asked. I would not have chosen for this to occur, but... Yes.
Detain him now,
Suko yelled. A pair of burly train guards, who had withdrawn las pistols from the express's emergency locker the moment the alarms had started sounding, stepped forward. There are three dead here. Three more outside, I said softly, looking into the trainmaster's electric shuttered eyes and pointedly ignoring the guards. All armoured, all armed. Combat warriors. Do you really think it's a good idea to mess with the man who killed them? Silence fell on the corridor, colder and harsher than the ice storm still gusting in through the shattered window. All eyes were on us, including, to Suko's discomfort, the last of the gawping passengers still being herded out. Shall we continue this in private? I suggested. We went into one of the vacated cabins. I opened the hinged wooden cover of the suite's little cogitator, switched it to hololithic mode, and pressed my signet ring against the data reader. The little desk projected a hologram of the inquisitorial seal, overlaid by credential details, followed by a slowly turning three-dimensional scan of my head. I am Inquisitor Gregor Eisenhorn of the Ordos Helicon. Suko and his guards were speechless. Do you accept that, or would you like me to rotate slowly in front of you until you're convinced? The trainmaster looked at me, so taken aback he barely knew what to say.
I'm sorry, my lord, he began. How can Transcontinental assist the work of the mighty Ordos?
Well, sir, you could get this train moving again for a start.
But I'd had enough.
I have been travelling incognito, sir, but not any more. And if I'm going to reveal myself as an Inquisitor, I'm damn well going to behave like one. This train is now under my control.
We remained halted long enough for the engineers to service the brakes and secure the exploded windows, and long enough for the train guards, under my direct supervision, to search the entire vehicle for any other passengers without tickets. Wrapped in crew-issue foul weather gear, I went outside and retrieved Barbarisata, which complained fractiously about being left in the blizzard. I sheathed the whining blade and went to check on the three Janissaries, who lay sprawled and stiffening in the snow. The express resumed progress at 5, and there were no more interruptions. We thundered out of the night and into a more temperate dawn, where the land was thick with snow, but the ice storms had abated. Suko raced the locomotive right up to the safety margins to make up time. The express cut down through the southern extremities of the Atenate Range, descending through hill country and rocky glacial plains. If I'd been awake, I would have seen hard pasture and scree slowly blooming into forest and deciduous woodland, and then the first little hamlets of the vast southern plateau, sunlit in the morning air. But I was deep asleep, my wounds dressed, Barbarisata slumbering fitfully at my side, and Crezia watching over me. I woke after 5, with the express still making excellent time. We were due in at New Givet at midnight. I'd given Suko strict instructions to send no word ahead of our plight. It was more likely that Pontius would try again at New Givet. I studied the route map and thought about getting Suko to make an unscheduled stop at one of the satellite stations in the towns north of New Givet. We could disembark and hire air transport, and the train could run on to the city. I thought my implacable and attentive enemy might anticipate this move, and I also considered that arriving in plain view at a major city terminal might be the safer plan. I lay on my cabin's cot, meditating as the lowland scenery of the plateau zipped by outside. Medea was up and around by then, hobbling painfully, and using, of all things, my rune staff as a crutch. Only she would have the wit to dare such disrespect. She limped into my cabin and flopped down on the edge of my cot, nursing her sore back. Crezia was asleep in the opposite berth.
Never a dull moment, eh? Said Medea.
Never. She nodded over at Crezia.
She didn't leave your side, Gregor, all day.
I know.
She's more than just an old friend, isn't she?
Yes, my dear.
You and your secrets.
I know.
You never told me.
I never told anyone. Crezia Bershildi deserved the privacy. She glanced at me.
Gregor Eisenhorn deserved the privacy too, don't you think? You may be a great and terrible inquisitor and everything, but you're a human being too. You have a life outside this awful work.
I thought about that. Sadly, I didn't agree.
But you're together again, then, you and the good doctor?
I have renewed a friendship I should never have allowed to lapse.
Yeah, right.
renewed. She made a surprisingly coarse and graphic gesture. I couldn't help but smile. Was there something else, or did you just come in to demonstrate the vulgar extremes of your miming ability? Yeah, there was something else. What do we do when we get there? New Givet was a cluster of monolithic hive pyramids covering the delta of the Sanas River. We could see its twinkling lights in the distance over an hour before we arrived. The Trans-Atenate Express rattled and hissed into the main terminal at 2 minutes to midnight. I got out ahead of the crowds and strode across the wide concourse under the arched glass roof to the Astropathic Guild's office near the freight cargo pens. I accessed the Aegis account and read the reply from Nail. He agreed that it was like the trouble on Ichan and cursed Sadia's name. He said the Caucus was ready to ship out and that he would be at a bar called Entipol's Lounge at noon the next day. The bar was in Hive 4, level 60. I looked at the communique sadly and then glanced at the waiting adept. Two-word reply. Rosethorn attends. Send it. I walked into Entipol's Lounge the next day at a minute before noon. It was a cage of aluminium tubes and spray-painted flakboard panels, artfully wired up so that the ropes of lights pulsed in time to the pound music the place pumped through the caster system. The place wanted to seem tough and underhive and dangerous, but it was all for show. This was a lunchtime and after-work watering hole for mid-hive clerks and administratum graders, a place for assignations with winsome girls from the logisticator pool, the celebrations that accompanied promotions or retirements or rowdy birthday drinks. I'd been into real twist bars and heard genuine pound. This place was just sham. Theatre. I was shrouded in Amos's overrobe, the hood pulled up, wearing a rebreather mask I'd borrowed from the Express. I wanted to look like some tech adept on his lunch break, or a werewright stealing off for a tryst with his girl. The place was largely empty. A bored-looking steward polished glasses behind the narrow sweep of the bar, and two uniformed waitresses chatted in the rear doorway, holding their glass trays like riot shields. Half a dozen men sat in the booths that radiated off the bar's central hub, and a hooded figure was sitting, drinking alone, with its back to the door. I sat at one of the hub tables. One of the waitresses approached. She smelled of obscura, and her penciled eyebrows framed widely dilated eyes.
Choice?
Tundery. Clear grain. Double. In a chill sleeve.
Doki-dok,
she returned as she stalked away. The music continued to blast. She returned with a single shot glass on her suspenser tray. The glass was actually a cup of pressure-molded ice. She tongued it onto my table and caught the coin I flipped at her. Keep the change, I murmured.
Big spender, she mocked and paced off, wiggling a backside that had no business being wiggled.
I didn't touch the drink. Gradually the ice melted and the oily liquid began to seep out over the tabletop. The hooded figure got up and wandered over to me.
Rosethorn?
I looked up. That's me. She dropped the hooded cloak away from her shoulders. She had sharp features and long, straight black hair. Her coal-edged eyes glinted like jade. Not Harlan Nail at all. Marla Tare. She sat down opposite me and knocked back my drink, licking the ice water off her long fingers.
You knew we'd get you sooner or later.
I guess so. Who's we? The other drinkers in the bar had got up and formed a circle around us, sitting at adjacent tables. Marla Tare clicked her fingers, and they all drew back coats or cloaks to reveal the handguns they carried. She clicked again, and the weapons disappeared. So this is a trap?
Of course.
The astrograms weren't from Nail.
Evidently.
You've broken Glossier.
How clever are we?
I sat back. How did you do that?
Wouldn't you like to know, Mr. Eisenhorn?
I shrugged. Seeing as you've got me cold, yes. These men are more of your damned Vessarine, aren't they? I'm dead in my seat. I can't see the harm.
I imagine you've guessed already, she said.
She smiled. I could feel her powerful mind trying to delve into mine. Yakut Vance.
That's right, Mr. Eisenhorn. Your astropath proved to be very useful, with the right persuasion. And the Janissaries excel at persuasion. Vance sent the communiques, pretending to be Nail. He knew Glossier.
She probed at my mind again.
You're using shielding techniques,
she said, her face darkening. Of course I am. You would be too if the situation was reversed. I have to say, though, I'm disappointed. I was hoping that Pontius might be here himself. This is a trap, after all. Eisenhorn's last stand. He might have been civil enough to come and watch me die.
Pontius is busy elsewhere,
she snapped, and then realized what she'd said. Thank you for that confirmation, I said.
You bastard, she snapped. You're dead. What good will it do you? This is a trap.
Yes, it is. A trap. She hesitated. The Janissaries had all risen, guns out, aiming at me. The bar staff were fleeing, terrified. Marla Tare slowly reached out and took the rebreather mask off my face.
Ettrick, she stammered,
her jade eyes wide. Yes, I said, 3 kilometers away in a locked lodging house room, sweating and straining as I channeled my will via the rune staff and animated the body of clan sire Ettrick. Tare leapt back from the table, knocking over her chair.
Damnation, she shrieked. He's got us! He's got us! How the hell did he know?
You could talk like Nail and use glossier thanks to Yekud, but Yekud didn't know what Nail knew. We fought Sadia on Lethi 11, not Ichan, I had Ettrick say. Marla Tare drew a plasma pistol and shot Ettrick through the chest. The Vessarines all around opened fire with their autoguns and las carbines. As my puppet was torn apart, I let go of the warp vortex that had been spinning in my mind ever since I had summoned it. It surged out of Ettrick's collapsing body and expanded, annihilating the Janissaries, Antipol's lounge, and the entire level 60 deck of Hive 4 in a radius of 50 meters. Marla Tare was atomized. In the last milliseconds of her life, her mental shields collapsed in terror, and I got a precious snapshot into her powerful psycho mind. Not everything, but enough. Enough to know that I had just annihilated Pontius Glaw's daughter.